Today is Wednesday, February 1st, 2023. This is part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Frank Barrios. Frank spells his last name B-A-R-R-I-O-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Frank. How are you today?
Good morning. Good morning.
Frank, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. At the end of part 4, you were really doing a lovely job of recounting some of your backpacking stories in Grand Canyon. Would you please continue with that?
Yes, I will. And this is out of step with the time frame, because one of the first trips, and I just remembered thinking about it, was that CL and I did together, and it was one of the first trips into the canyon, so a very early one, that we went down the Hermit and turned, instead of going straight down to where the old cabin used to be down there, we turned off on the Boucher Trail.
Okay.
And went down, there was that overhang where we visited that. And then we went down to the Boucher, where it drops down into the canyon. There's nothing left of the trail. It's all bushwhacking. But we dropped down the Boucher and walked all the way down to the Colorado River there and visited Boucher's cabin.
Ah, yes.
And his mine. And we spent the night there, in fact.
Okay.
At the cabin and the mine. And then the plan was to follow the Colorado River all the way back up to the Bright Angel Trail and come up the Bright Angel.
Oh, very nice. Frank, I want to stop for a minute here, just so that the transcribers know. CL stands for Claude Johnson. And then do you remember roughly what year this would have been?
It was one of the first Grand Canyon trips. Where we got serious about canyon hiking. I'm not even sure. I think I had left the Bureau already, so maybe not. Let's say somewhere in the 70s.
Okay.
Might have been early, let's say mid-70s.
Approximately 1975, about.
Approximately.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. So.
And yeah, go ahead.
Well, so down the Hermit Trail, off on the Boucher Trail, past White's Butte, I believe, and then down into Boucher, toward Boucher Canyon or Boucher Creek, and
correct. We went all the way to the river to see it, and then came back up and spent the night at the cabin.
And then the idea is to walk the Tonto Trail east a number of miles past Monument and Salt Creek and all the way to what would be Indian Gardens.
That's correct.
Okay. How did that work out? What did you do?
Oh, it was a wonderful trip. It was every chance we got, we'd go down to the river and then come back up to Tonto. And we had a great trip. One incident I always remember, for chuckles anyway, we were heading down the trail and two girls came up to us.
Huh.
Yeah, young girls, much younger than us. And they said, they sort of looked at the ground and she said, "This is very difficult for a young girl to say this to older men," she said. And I said, "Oh my goodness, what's going to happen here?" And she said, "You were back there in that last campground where you camped, and we were camped there also. We had talked to them, and this is embarrassing, but I think I left my marijuana back there." Did you find it? And I said, "No, we did not find it." And so they continued going back to try to find the marijuana they left at their campground.
Oh, my gosh. 1975.
Anyway,
Yeah, Frank, before you keep going on this hike, I want to back up a minute. Did you guys have to get a permit to do that hike? Do you remember? Did CL pick that up?
No, I don't think we needed a permit back then.
Okay.
I may be wrong. I could be wrong. I don't know.
Okay.
I really don't know. I'm trying to remember. CL did all of that. When it came to permits, all I did was CL would call me and say, let's do this trail. And I'd say, sure, that sounds like a good trip. And I'd join him, and he would handle the permit stuff.
Okay, well, you don't remember going to the backcountry permit office with him while he talked to people about what you guys were going to do?
No.
Okay.
I didn't. And we visited, of course, the old lodge. It used to be the down on the Tonto. There was an old...
Oh, the hermit camp, the tramway camp.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you remember about that?
Well, everything had been removed. There wasn't much left.
Okay.
But there was still, you could make the, you knew where it was.
Okay.
And of course, the trail would disappear in places. And we bushwhacked and would find the trail again. We followed the Tonto, basically.
Okay.
And let's see. I need to write these things down, but one other, I also, a couple of times did Thunder River.
Okay, hang on a second. Wait.
Yeah.
Before we leave this hike, past Monument, did it take you, a couple days to get to Indian Gardens?
Right, correct.
Okay.
We were in no hurry, but I will tell you one thing during that trip. And this is why I'm sure it was legal what we did. A ranger met us.
Oh.
And I can't remember his name, but he camped with us.
Oh, nice.
And we had a friendly meeting with him, and he was a young man, a ranger. So we talked to him, and we actually hiked with him for a little ways in that trip.
Nice.
And I also remember one trip he says, I got to check out something down here. We went down with him, and there was a couple nude bathing on the Colorado River.
Uh-huh.
And he warned them. He didn't arrest them or anything, but just, you know, warned them not to do what they were doing. And we got an eye for this couple that were there naked swimming. So.
Uh-huh.
But the guy was a very nice man, and we spent the night with him one night and talked about Grand Canyon, and he hiked with us for a ways and then left us. But anyway, I remembered that.
Nice. And so you got to Indian Gardens, and then of course up the trail to the rim.
Correct.
Correct. With maybe a pretty nice sense of accomplishment.
Well, it was. It was, and it was one of the first Grand Canyon off the map hikes that I had taken.
Okay.
And basic CL too. I don't think CL had done much before that either.
Okay.
So this is one of the first of our, and then of course it's like everything. You get addicted to the canyon, and it kept getting growing and growing until we did more.
Yeah.
And
then from there, it was off to Thunder River?
Did Thunder River a couple of times. What we did was, the one trip I did with some guys I worked with, Willie Samuel, the black engineer I
yep.
told you about, and Don Gross, another guy who used to work with us. The three of us did Thunder River one year, but I think it was, I may be wrong, but I think it was before the Bill Hart Trail. So you had to go down from Indian Hollow, which of course made a much longer trek.
Yeah, the Thunder River Trail versus the Bill Hall Trail, sort of shortcut.
Correct.
Okay.
But we did the long one.
Okay.
We came off Indian Hollow. I'm not sure the Bill Hall was even there yet. I may be wrong.
It was there. People were using it. I don't know that it was official yet, but it had been used for a while by people who knew the shortcut.
Right, and we took the long way, and then we not only visited Thunder River, we went down to do the Pete's Creek, then we came back up and we went over to Deer Creek.
Wow.
And we went all the way through that little narrow area all the way to where the falls were.
Oh, did you actually hike down to the river there then?
No, we didn't. Okay. We just went to the falls at the top.
Okay, so through the narrows and could get that incredible view.
That's correct. And then, remember I told you we did Indian Hollow and followed up down Kanab, followed the Colorado up to that same Deer Creek Falls. There we did climb up the falls and follow that way back up.
Okay. Yeah, because you were coming in overland from the west. Got it.
That's correct. And but this was the first time I had seen Deer Creek.
Okay.
This trip with these two other engineers. And it was a fabulous trip. I really enjoyed it. Kind of scary going through the narrows there, but it was great. It was a great trip. And then we went back up the long way back to our car.
Did you cache some water along the way?
We didn't. And okay. We really suffered for that. In fact, one of the engineers got really sick before we got to Thunder River.
Oh.
And we were out of, it was a very hot day, very hot. And we were going to leave him behind because he couldn't go any farther. The third person, and we said we'll give you our water. We were in better shape than he was, and just near where you drop down into the Esplanade. We're on the Esplanade now, where you drop down into that flat area where Thunder River is.
Yes.
We left him there. And we filled his canteen, and we figured we were in better shape. We could make it to Thunder River and fill our canteens at that point.
Okay.
But it turns out that he panicked after we left, and he followed us, and we all met at Thunder River.
Okay.
And we spent the night there, and I always remember we had tents. And the wind was really blowing hard, and Willie wasn't very big. And Willie said he almost got blown off into the canyon.
Oh, my.
He was spread out, eagle, trying to keep from being blown into the canyon that night. I always remember that.
Huh.
And CL's trips that he had taken to Thunder River, CL would go up to Pete's Creek to where the Pete's Creek comes out of the canyon.
Okay.
And I had not been with CL when he did that, but there were trips that CL would follow up to Pete's Creek, and I believe he had pictures of where the Pete's Creek comes out of the canyon there where it starts.
Right, at the Pete's Creek caves up there.
Correct. CL had done that and taken pictures of that trip.
Okay,
and,
nice.
And CL had also been from the Pete's to Deer Creek across that area also.
Okay.
But anyway, that was more or less our Thunder River. The other one, I'll just mention this. You know, I did a paper on called Revisited, the Howell brothers and Dunn, the tragedy of the three that left the Powell expedition and were killed.
Yes.
I did a paper on that, and basically today it's a toss-up whether the Mormons killed them or the Indians killed them.
Okay.
Even though for years everybody thought the Indians had killed them, but keep in mind when that happened, it was Jacob Hamblin, the only one that could speak Paiute, that told Powell that they admitted to the killing.
Right.
And because if Powell thought that the Mormons had killed them, the army would have been there arresting because they were trying to find out who had done the Mountain Meadows massacre. But one of the trips that I took, this was the last of my trips into the canyon.
Okay.
I got a call from a guy named Howland. He was living in Sedona, and he was a relative of the Howland brothers.
Ah.
And he was like 90 years old, was an old guy. And he had been trying to find out what happened to his relatives.
Okay.
And he said, I'm going to take a boat ride done by the Indians of Peach Springs.
The Hualapai?
Hualapai tribe has a boat that they take through the canyon, and you come out where that big glass enclosure is.
Right.
He said, I'm going to do there, and they stopped for lunch at Separation Canyon.
Okay.
And it's part of my quest to find out what happened to my relatives.
Oh, wow.
And I said, you know what? I'll join you.
Nice.
So I called, made reservations, and I met him there at the hotel at Peach Springs. And then that morning they took you down to the river, and I took a boat ride from there to the, and they take you out by helicopter at where the glass encampment is.
Okay.
And we stopped at Separation Canyon, and he was about 90 years old. And this was my last trip into the canyon, but one of the things that was interesting, I don't know what they had some pretty good rapids that you go through there.
Right.
And boy, it messed up my balance. And not only me, but this older guy, he's 90 years old. The minute he set foot down, he came. He had blood running down his head from the... Evidently, if you get older, it can affect your balance during on those boat rides.
Okay.
And
did he fall?
Yeah, we both fell. I was struggling to keep my balance the whole trip.
Oh, my gosh.
As long as I was in the boat, I was all right. But the minute I got up to stand, I had to be really careful. And I broke my glasses, and he had blood streaming down his head. But, but I've had ear problems before. And that was interesting meeting him. But that was like 20 years ago, and I think by now he's probably dead. He was like 90 at the time. So but he was living in Sedona, but he was his goal in life was to try to find out what happened to his descendants.
Okay.
And I didn't take any pictures, but they take pictures of rafting down the through the rapids, and they sell them back to you. The Indians did.
Oh, uh-huh.
I have pictures of me doing the rapids, and they were pretty good rapids. I don't know what the numbers on them are, but they were enough to mess up my inner ear.
Wow.
And but it was a really fabulous trip, I thought. But that was another, if you will, side trip that I took.
Okay. Hey,
and
Frank. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, the other thing, in order, that paper that I mentioned to you that I did, just a few years back, I went down into the Strip country to do research on how the Powell Brothers got out, and by myself, by the way. I went all the way to the point right where the Separation Canyon comes above ground, and I spent about a week in the strip country trying to find out what happened.
Okay.
And I took a picture, a unique picture of Separation Canyon.
Okay.
Really good quality. And I saw an advertisement where they said they had a computer that would actually paint you a picture from a photograph. And I had the picture. I created, I sent it in. It didn't cost a lot. But And they sent me a beautiful painting.
Oh, wow.
And it looks like of Separation Canyon from... to take that picture, I had to drive 100 miles on a dirt road, and I had to hike about 6 miles to get to the point right above the Separation Canyon to get the picture.
Wow.
So, and I'm willing to donate that painting to the Historical Society if you want. It's a unique, I don't think you anybody has, it's a full-size painting of Separation Canyon from a unique perspective.
Okay. You know what? Let's talk about this after the interview's over.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And but anyway, when I was done, I did a paper on the Powell Brothers, where I think happened and where I think they came out. One of the things from that picture I took, there's no way you could come. They had to come up. I don't know if you're aware of it, but in the 1950s or 60s, there was a Prescott professor from Prescott that actually climbed out of Separation Canyon and went up to Dellenbaugh and found the rocks with the carvings there.
Right.
And I and he, that same path that he took was the only way out of Separation.
Right.
So it had to be that's the one they took. And then I climbed Dellenbaugh and found the rock also, and I have pictures of that in my paper.
Okay.
And I gave several presentations in St. George, Utah, too, on it.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, that's, let's see, the other, I did the Tanner, I also almost forgot. I did the South Pass all the way to the river also.
Oh, okay. Nice.
And I found it interesting. We explored the steel boat that's down by the river.
Yeah, the Ross Wheeler down there.
Yeah, we looked at that, looked inside of it and everything. These were guys I was working with at the Department of Water Resources. One the CL trip. Two came for CL, I guess, but... we just took the South Bass all the way down to the river, and then came back up, we did that all in one day, and then spent the night right at the top of the rim.
That's a long hike to do in a day, all the way down and back.
It was, but we didn't have our packs were in the car, so we did it without packs.
Okay, just as a day hike, sure.
Day hike to the river and then back up again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was, and of course, not far from the South Bass is CL did all three of the natural bridges.
Okay.
There's one of the natural bridges is there near the South Bass, which CL had done. We didn't do it. We our goal was just to get to the river and come back up, and that was adequate for us. And then we spent the night, and then the next morning we drove back out to, went back to Phoenix.
Nice, very nice.
And those are pretty much all my trips that I can think of. I did a lot of exploring up around the North Rim.
Okay.
But I pretty well covered. Oh, the other trip I took was the, what's the one there at the North Rim? I can't think of it now. The It's the trail to the west of the main lodge there.
Oh, the Widfirth.
Yeah. It's to the west of the lodge.
Oh, west. Yeah, west. That's right. Yeah, the Widfirth trail.
I took that all the way to the end of that and then came back up on that. And then, the other thing we did was one trip. There were several trips with CL that we were going to do the North Rim and got canceled. Usually the snow, because of the heat was a big enemy, as you know.
Right.
And we kept trying to get earlier and earlier to do our hikes. But many times our hikes were spoiled. We'd get the permits, but then we couldn't get to the trailhead because there was too much snow.
Okay.
So our trip would be spoiled. One of those trips was with CL, and we decided to go to Tora Week.
Okay.
And we decided to do the lava trail.
Okay.
And so we went down there, set up camp. I think we spent two nights. We basically were going to do a trip. It would take 4 or 5 days, but everything had been messed up. So we went, spent one night at Tora Weep, and then we went down to the lava trailhead and went down to the river. And
what time of year was this?
It's what now?
What time of year was this?
What kind of what now?
What time of year? Was it cool? Because that can be really hot in the summer.
Oh, no, it was terribly hot. Oh, God, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
That was a killer. It was hotter than hell. The heat was terrible.
Gosh.
But of course, CL made it to the river, and one of the guys fell on going down and broke 3 ribs.
Oh, my.
But he came back up. We were all camping that night. He kept saying how painful his ribs were. And
yeah.
The next day, he went to the hospital and found out he broke 3 ribs.
Oh.
I think it was Dave Peters, which is the old high school buddy of CL that had joined us.
Okay.
And but there were several that the heat was a problem. That was just hotter than hell down there.
Mm.
But of course CL and I think one other person made it all the way to the river, and they took pictures of some guys doing the rapids there at Lava Falls.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they came back up. We a spoiled trip, but not without getting some hiking done on that.
Yeah.
And one other trip you might laugh. I don't know which. I agreed to drop CL off on one of Harvey's big trips, and we spent the night at Point Sublime.
Okay.
And the next morning, near Point Sublime, there's a big cliff there that Harvey had done.
Okay.
And we went down to it and looked down. It was impossible to climb that cliff.
Hmm.
But Harvey had done it. I asked CL, he said Harvey had, even on a helicopter, supposedly he had studied it for a long time before he tried it.
Hmm, okay.
But CL, even CL wouldn't try that. So again, it was a canceled trip. But instead, CL found another place to drop off the canyon and came out on the North Bass Trail and climbed back up the other side.
Oh, nice.
But one of the things we noticed while we were there was the helicopter kept hovering off of an area near Point Sublime. So we decided to find out what they were. It was a tourist helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
So we went over there and dropped off the canyon and found those ruins.
Right.
Where they would store food.
Right, the granaries.
Granary. And there was a huge granary down there just below the rim. And we went down and visited those granary.
Nice.
And then climbed back up again. It's not far from the top of the rim, but it was pretty steep to get down there. But we took a bunch of pictures. If you look at the pictures that I donated, you'll see the granary in there.
And that would have been that would have been in, again, the 1970s?
Yeah, probably. It would have been the 70s. And,
okay.
It was a interesting, it was a granary, and, we took a lot of pictures of it and then climbed back out. And then that's when CL decided to try another route. And that canyon that comes to the east of, the Bass Trail, there's a big canyon in there. East of the Bass Trail.
Right, Shinumu Creek.
Shinumo, Shinumo.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's the one he dropped down into.
Yeah.
And then he went all the way down Shinumo to where it reached the creek where the North Bass Trail is.
Right.
And then he climbed back out the North Bass Trail.
I think that arm is the Flint Canyon. It goes around to Shinumo there. Yeah, it's a pretty brushy up at the top, but it's a pretty wonderful hike.
Well, he made that hike.
And, nice.
And that was a second choice. Because,
did you drive around and pick him up at the top of the North Bass Trail?
That's correct.
Cool.
That's correct. And he was going to do the other Harvey Trail, but I'll tell you, I saw that cliff. And you can't be human to come up that cliff. There was no way, but somehow Harvey had done it. And according to what I heard, he had done a lot of research on it before he did it. He studied it and did all kinds of things and then eventually climbed up that cliff. But and CL was going to do it, but even CL wouldn't do that.
How many days did it take CL to go from where you dropped him off at Point Sublime to the top of the North Bass Trailhead at Swamp Point?
I think they did it in one day.
One day? Wow.
Yeah, they because they were planning on a several day, had a permit, but not for that particular one, but it served when you take annual leave and you do that, you can't get your time back, and so we looked for something that and I always enjoyed. Well, if it was in that particular, I always enjoyed going down there. And of course, I think what I did while CL was climbing, I went down to the cabin there at the saddle where the North Bass is,
and the Powell Plateau there. Yeah.
That's right, and then there's a spring there near that saddle also.
Right.
If you can get good water, good fresh water out of that spring.
Oh, nice. So you had a good adventure while they had a good adventure.
Exactly.
Nice.
And I think that pretty well covers all of my, other than I gave several papers to the Historical Society and was published in your symposiums.
Proceedings, yes.
And if you look through many of them, you'll find my papers in there. One on the Powell brothers. I did another on Ghost Rock. And, I can't think of... I did a lot of papers for the Historical Society also that I did on history.
Nice. Thank you. Frank, I wanted to ask you a sort of a philosophical question about wilderness and about its inspirational value for you personally. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. No, I think human beings can get addicted to anything, whether it's dope, women, If you do it long enough, you get addicted to it. And there is an appeal of the Grand Canyon. Harvey is the extreme, but I found myself in that same appeal. There's something about the Grand Canyon that just draws you to it. And the inspiration of seeing places so beautiful and so remote was fantastic. And had become to a certain extent addicted to the canyon and kept getting attracted back to it again and again. And of course, I additionally had a strong attraction for history. So I always the only other, just to mention this briefly, I almost forgot, I also did the, I don't know what the name of it is, but the one down to where the, I think it's the Tanner, where there's a mine down in there.
The Tanner off to the Beamer, to the Little Colorado River, so that's the Palisades, the McCormick mine in there.
Oh, yeah. I did go down to that also and explored the mine, and then there's a little cabin there that they had, a rock stone cabin that still was pretty well standing.
This was at the confluence of the Little Colorado, the Beamer cabin?
No, it was, this is...
Or out by the Palisades.
This is up on the Tonto.
Okay.
And there was a cabin there, and then there was a mine nearby. And I did spend the night there one time and did.
Okay.
And I can't remember the name of the trail that goes down to it.
Not the Grand View.
Yeah, the Grand View. Probably the Grand. But I also did the. I hiked all the way to the Little Colorado also.
Okay.
What would that be? That'd be the.
The Beamer.
Boomer, yeah. I did that a couple of times.
Okay.
But anyway, just to finish up. But the only other thing I got left to mention to you is the runs that we did.
Okay.
And you're going to get a better feel for that from Charlie, because he's the one that created them. But we started a program, just a few of us to start with, and Charlie started it, and he had some people that came out of Las Vegas that would join us. They would fly in, and we'd pick them up at the airport, and we'd head to the North Rim. And the first year, it was just a few of us. The next year, we had people coming in from all over the United States to take part in this race.
Oh, Frank, wait. Hang on a second. So let me make sure I understand this. First of all, do you have any rough idea of the time frame? Was this in the 80s or the 70s? When was this?
This would have been in the late 80s through the early 90s.
Okay. So the late 1980s. And so were you running, were you jogging in Phoenix? Were you a runner? Is this something, I mean, because you...
I did a couple of 10Ks here in Phoenix.
Okay.
And I used to always, before I did the canyon, all of us had, if you want a little added story, we used to hike, and CL would run it. I would just stay in shape. We'd go out by Sunflower here in north of Phoenix, and we would run the mountains in there.
Okay.
To try to stay in shape.
Okay.
And I did Piestewa Peak. I did Camelback Mountain. Those are how we kept in shape.
Okay.
For the canyon and
All right. That makes sense. As you know, you guys were already conversant with some trail running, some steep trail running, and so the rim to rim wouldn't be that far of a step. To the next thing.
The other thing, just to as a summary, I once both CL and I, when we'd go up to Sunflower and hike that, we both run into bears.
Oh, my.
They were close to it. There were a lot of bears up in the Sunflower area.
Okay.
And I remember I was by myself wearing a pair of running shorts, and I looked, and there was a bear track over my track, and I said, my God.
Oh, my.
A bear, and I looked over there right next to me. There was this bear growling.
Oh, my.
Oh, shit, I'm dead, I said. But I didn't move. I figured I'd try running, but I wasn't going to outrun him if he came after me. And then CL ran into a bear one time running in the mountains also.
Hmm.
There were tracks everywhere. The bear up in that Sunflower area were everywhere.
Oh, wow. Huh.
But we also would do Piestewood Peak and Camelback to keep in shape.
So this was Charlie Schultz's idea. Let's run North Rim, South Rim?
Correct.
And how were you going to arrange the transport? How did that very first time you remember doing that? How did that all work? The first time.
Chuck rented a bus, and we paid Chuck. All of us would kick in so much money for a bus.
Okay, and, like a van or a real full big on bus.
A real bus.
Okay.
And we all paid so much in for it. We'd all get in the bus in Phoenix, with the exception we'd pick up a couple of guys at the Flagstaff Airport that would fly in from Las Vegas.
Okay.
And we had a great time. Everybody partied, and we went to the North Rim, spent the night, got up right at daybreak, took a picture of all of us. If you look through my pictures, you'll see the group there. And then we'd start from the North Rim and come up to Bright Angel. And that's about 22 miles.
Yeah, was this in the fall, like maybe before the lodge closed, or what time of year was that?
If I remember, it was the fall.
Okay.
And it was just before they closed. And,
okay, when the weather was cooler and the leaves were turning a little, maybe.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And at the end of the journey on the South Rim, we would give trophies to first, second, and third. And
okay.
Everybody that took that finished the run would get a T-shirt and a flannel shirt with a picture of the hike we did in the back, and a picture of a guy with his tongue hanging out trying to reach the South Rim.
Okay.
And I've got several of those T-shirts and flannel shirts that we all got as a remembrance of our run.
So while you guys were running, the bus would be driving around to pick you up at the south side. Would you spend the night at the South Rim?
That's correct.
Okay.
And by the way, some of the more stringent good runners like CL would try to get to the South Rim before the bus got there.
Right. I was going to say they had a shorter distance, though they were on foot. But still, they could give it a go.
And they did. I don't remember. Chuck can give you all the details. I was never a winner. But give you an example. I think CL, and Chuck has all this in writing, but I think CL once did it in 4.5 hours.
Wow.
And I did it, and best time I ever did was 7 hours.
Okay, seven's, wow, that's amazing.
That's still good. I mean,
yeah.
That's a hell of a run. But, of course, you wreck your knees going down, and then you better be in good shape coming back
up the other side.
And we picked the Bright Angel instead of the South Kaibab because of the water.
Okay.
And one story, there's many stories, but one of them, we had a young kid from a runner. We were all older guys, too, which is interesting because it was appealed to guys that were older in age. There was one guy that was in his 70s, I think, that was doing the Rocky Mountains and all kinds of. It was a mixed group, but generally they were older men.
Okay.
But towards the end, we actually had women joining us, older women.
Okay.
But one year we had a young kid who was and he looked around, laughed. He thought he could just. He passed out going up the other side.
Oh my!
And the older guys made it. So let's hear a little jingle for older guys. We were all older. And what stopped it is one of the park rangers stopped Chuck Schultz, who was the guy that was doing all this, and he told him, "Do you have a permit?" And Chuck said, "No, we didn't think we needed one." And he said, "Well, you're going to stop what you're doing." And he said, "Why? We're not hurting anybody." "Well, we might have to rescue you." And Chuck told him, "You haven't yet. We've been doing it for 6 years or so, and we haven't had to rescue us yet." And the guy, "I don't care. If I see you here next year again, I'm going to fine you $5,000.
Okay.
So that ended our Grand Canyon runs.
Huh. And this would have been 1985-ish? Or sorry, 1995, I'm sorry.
Somewhere around 1995, I think.
Okay. Okay.
And, but again, Chuck will have all, he kept records. He was the guy behind the runs. And Chuck is going to be a real plus for you because he's an engineer also. He was a CEO with a big company, and most of the people he got came out of the corporate world that were interested in taking part in this, and people that he had worked with, but he also had the connection with CL and myself, and we've shared, and in fact, the last thing that you might ask Chuck that CL and him were doing, they were going to run the Arizona Trail.
Oh, uh-huh,
and,
right.
I had no ambition to run the Arizona Trail or even walk it. But they were running it, and they were doing it in segments, and I used to be there. I would drop them off at a place, and then I would, at some place where they would run for a day, I would set up a camp there, and then they would spend the night, and then continue on with another segment of the Arizona Trail, and then at the end of that, they'd come back to Phoenix. It was Saturday and Sunday because they were still working. All of us were still working.
Nice. So you would get them to the trailhead. They'd take off running. You would drive them to where they were going to end at the end of the day and set up camp for them. So they would come into camp and everything would be there. They would eat. They would sleep. They would get up in the morning and run again?
That's correct.
And nice.
The idea was to come from Mexico to Utah on the Arizona Trail.
And did they do that?
I don't think they ever finished it. CL died, and I don't think Chuck ever finished it either.
Okay.
But the plan was to do the really rough places while they were still able.
Well, that makes
sense. And then as they got older, they would do the easier parts.
Yeah.
So, like an example, they did Mount Lemmon.
Okay.
The Arizona Trail goes over the top of Mount Lemmon and right outside of, what's the name? That Oracle, right outside
yep.
of Oracle is
yep.
where the Arizona Trail comes down. I would pick them up there, and I would drop them off somewhere below Tucson.
Okay.
And they would run up Mount Lemmon and down the other side.
Wow.
And I could pick them up on the far side. Then they did the superstitions, and that was rough because you couldn't even find the trails in those days. Those were early days. Today, the Arizona Trail Association is trying to improve those trails so that people can find it, but CL was good at it. And
right.
Right there where you, just before you get to Superior on the highway from Phoenix, the Arizona Trail crosses there. goes over the top of the Superstition Mountain and comes out just upstream from Roosevelt Dam.
Okay.
So you then cross Roosevelt Dam, you go over the top of Four Peaks, go over the Mazatzholtz into the Mogollon Rim, and then over to Flagstaff, and then you go down the Grand Canyon on the one of the Bright Angel or the South Cab, whichever is considered the Arizona Trail, come up the other side, and then from there you can run all the way to the Utah border.
Right. Did you give them support across the Grand Canyon? Did they run that section? Well, they would have run it already, but...
I picked them up. They finished all of that area from the Grand Canyon, and they did the area from the North Rim to the Utah border.
Okay.
And, of course, the North Rim to the Utah border was a piece of cake. It's almost flat through there.
Yeah.
And but the Grand Canyon, of course, they ran that. And but they did it in segments, and they did the Mogollon Rim across the Mazatzholtz, and Mount Lemmon was a huge hike.
Yeah, you bet.
And they started, I think, they went over the Huachuca Mountains, and it starts in right on the Mexican border, goes over the top of the Huachuca Mountains, and then to Mount Lemmon, and then over it crosses the Gila River at Winkelman, outside of Winkelman, there's
okay.
a bridge there. And then you go through that wilderness area there and end up just south of Superior, and then you go over the top of the Superstitions, come out just upstream from Roosevelt, cross the river there at Roosevelt, and then go over the top of Four Peaks, and then down across the Mazatzholtz, over the Mogollon Rim, over to Flagstaff.
Nice. Yeah, it's a lovely country.
Yeah.
Very cool. Frank, when did you finally retire?
1998.
Okay. And then did you just hang up your hat, or did you keep doing consulting work after that?
No, what I kept busy with, just to let you know, I'm getting an award by the History Makers on the 23rd of February, which is, it's a big thing. It's they've given awards to Rose Mofford, Barry Goldwater.
Nice, congratulations.
So I'm joining, thank you. And it's on the 23rd at the Historical Society, because what I did was launch into what you might call my other main thing that I consider very strongly, which is history.
Okay.
And I did a lot. I've written two books, one called The Mexicans of Phoenix, and the other, I did a lot of civil rights issues with St. Vincent de Paul. I was immediate past president of St. Vincent de Paul. I belonged to the Pioneer Cemetery Association, First Families of Arizona.
Ah.
I was on the board of directors of many 18 different organizations. The governor appointed me to the Centennial Commission. I've got awards galore. I also, governor appointed me to the Central Arizona Project Board of Directors.
Oh, wow.
And I served between 2003 and 2006
okay.
on the board of directors for the Arizona Historical, the CAP.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ran because it's an elected position, and I lost the election.
Okay.
So it ended my political career. But I have tons of awards on everything
nice.
You can think of that I launched after I retired. I was worried about how I was going to keep busy, but it never happened. I wrote books. I got involved in history. Did a lot of work with the Kino Border Initiative with St. Vincent de Paul. I became the president of the board. I was the last president of the board of directors. And again, this award is coming up February 23rd. It'll be a very, very large, important award.
Oh, lovely. Again, congratulations. That's really nice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very cool. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got into the history of the Mexicans of Phoenix book, and how did you research that?
My family was part of the Mexican history. My mother and father, I mentioned, their first language was Spanish.
Right.
And mine is English. But my father was very active in the Mexican community, and my mother comes from a family that dates back to when Arizona belonged to Mexico.
Right.
And so it was, I heard many stories, and basically my family was part of the history, the Mexican history of Phoenix.
Well, today, you know, and we've got Ancestry.com and all these other websites for this, but I'm assuming that back in 1998, when you would have first become interested in maybe focusing on this, the computer wasn't quite up to speed as a resource that it is today.
No, we didn't. One of the things that launched me off into a lot of it, there was a group of us, professors from ASU, myself, and others, that Phoenix did a property survey, properties that would be important to the Mexican community. And I threw my hat in there, and we got the contract from the city of Phoenix.
Hmm.
And it took about a year of researching professors from ASU, myself. We interviewed people that were still alive about the history, and we put together, it's called the Phoenix City of Phoenix Property Survey.
Wow.
And in there we have interviews of older Mexicans about what they remember, and the end result of all this was to identify properties that were important to the Mexican community.
Nice.
Included like Immaculate Heart of Mary, the St. Francis Cemetery. Maybe over 50% of the people buried there are Mexican Americans. And
okay.
That's when I did my book on the Mexicans of Phoenix.
Nice.
I had all this data that.
Yeah.
We had researched, and that was basically
lovely how that came about.
So
nice.
Today I'm still a member of First Families of Arizona. Those, and that's families that came to Arizona prior to statehood.
Okay.
And it's all the old time families of Arizona are members of that.
Okay.
And we meet once a month, and Pioneer Cemetery Association, which is a group that studies the burials in our pioneer cemeteries in Phoenix.
And, okay.
And then I'm a member of the Kino Border Initiative, which deals with migrants in Mexico that cross, attempting to help them. And then St. Vincent de Paul, I'm immediate past president, and I finished the book on the history of the Phoenix St. Vincent de Paul. And by the way, Phoenix St. Vincent de Paul is the largest in the world. And we're in 150 countries throughout the world. Our main office is in Paris, France. And the largest in the entire world, including the United States, is here in Phoenix, Arizona.
Huh, nice.
Unbelievable nice. Success story. And I wrote the history of how we got there.
Excellent.
And that's about it. And of course, right now I've got a line of people interviewing me about the history and the knowledge I know on the Mexicans, on the also history of Arizona. My family, not only for the Mexicans, my grandfather, my mother's father came to Arizona in 1878 from Yugoslavia.
Right, you mentioned that on my first interview. Yeah.
Right, and he has. Was one of the premier pioneers of early Phoenix, and
yeah,
and his wife was Mexican American. Like
Frank,
I
wanted to take this time to ask you, when these days, when I hear, you know, the first families of Arizona prior to statehood, what I think of is 10,000 years or more of indigenous peoples that were the first families of Arizona.
Correct.
How are you going about, how are historians today going about seeking the indigenous peoples out and trying to record their stories of their generational presence in Arizona?
Well, right now we're not recording. All it is a social group of the old-timers, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, Native Americans are welcome to attend. But I'll give you an example. Last Tuesday, we meet the last Tuesday of every month. And somebody gives a presentation on some form of Arizona history.
Nice.
And then we have dinner, and we have maybe 50 people, depending on the presentation. Sometimes we draw more people for the presentation.
But, okay.
And this last presentation was Dr. Pagan. I don't know if you know him. He's a professor at ASU. He comes out on PBS quite a bit.
No, how does he spell his last name?
P-A-G-A-N.
Thank you.
And he gave a presentation about the Pleasant Valley War.
Okay.
And at that meeting were the descendants of the Tewksbury family.
Okay.
And they were, the Grahams and the Tewksbury were the two families that were fighting in that battle.
Right.
And it was interesting, we asked one of them to give a presentation, and of course his side of the story is completely different from the historical side, that his relative would never have shot anybody in the back as Tom Graham was killed. But we don't have any Native American. We have Mexican Americans.
Okay.
We have some black folks that attend, but Native American is basically open to anybody whose family was here before statehood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the connection has not been made with the Native American tribe.
Okay.
One of the people that has been interviewing me here is the president of the board of the Heard Museum here in Phoenix.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And Norma Jean Coulter.
Great.
And she's did a oral interview on me. And I think one of the connections I've got with the tribe is that when I was on the CAP board, I voted to end give the water rights to the Gila River tribe. We agreed on an agreement. It was very controversial. Many people we gave too much water to the Indians to settle the claims. But the Gila River tribe had a very, very good claim on water.
Yeah, yeah. I just found it fascinating that the Gila Indians were using the Gila to grow fruits and vegetables that they trucked and transported to Tucson during the time of Father Kino. I mean, they had a clear first rights, first in time with water law, and yet they were denied so much water for so many decades.
That's because the Mormons started diverting water out of the Gila River, and then as you went downstream, the farmers around Florence Coolidge started diverting water.
Yep.
And the Gila River happened to be at the end, and what happened is the river dried up on them. And then they became wards of the government. And
but first in rights, first in line meant that the Safford and Florence diversions were taking their water. Yes,
exactly.
Amazing
right.
History.
But nobody would fight for them. And here we are now, 100 years later.
Right.
And we're sitting down. There was a huge settlement. The Salt River Project, all the irrigation districts of Pinal County, the state of Arizona, all sat down with the tribe to come up with a settlement.
Nice.
And the truth of the matter is, none of those people would have agreed on anything except the feds attended the meeting with a big pocketbook and paid off everybody. And the only thing that was left was the Indians. They took the money, but they also said, you know what, we want water also.
Yeah.
So the CAP voted, and it was very controversial, and we gave them quite a bit of CAP water.
Okay.
And I voted for it, as a member of the CAP board. And but they were, I always remember a guy from the audience coming up to me and pointing his finger at me and said, 100 years from now, people will be spitting on your grave for giving our water to the Indians.
Oh, no, they won't. You know, there's always somebody somewhere. The exception proves the rule.
Of all the tribes in Arizona, the Gila River has the best claim.
Yeah.
Because they were screwed. And you're right, first in time, first in use, but somehow the Gila decree, which is a mess, basically attempted to try to put legal wings on the whole Gila River, but it's a mess because they contradict themselves in the Gila decree, and it was a meeting of lawyers that put together something that is a mess. If you lawsuits, many attorneys got rich overnight putting the Gila decree together, but again, it was the one that got screwed with the Indians.
Yeah.
But no, when Coolidge Dam was built, half the water behind Coolidge Dam goes to the Gila River tribe.
Okay.
The other half goes to the white farmers in Coolidge. So that gave them some water, but not like what they had been farming for years on the Gila River, that was an attempt to try to buy off the Gila River when they built Coolidge Dam.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to, you know, I think now when I think of Arizona pioneers, pioneer families, I think indigenous, and where are those people? How do we as historians start incorporating them and tracking them down, embracing them into the concept of pioneer heritage?
Right. But I'm going to have to run. I think we've done our hour.
We have.
I've got some people here.
Awesome.
But if tomorrow is Thursday, if you want to call me, we can finish it. I think we're up pretty much at the end, but it's up to you how.
Let's conclude this interview then, but stay on the line. This will conclude Part 5 Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Frank Barrios. Today is the 1st of February, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Frank, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.